Hello and welcome to another episode of Podcast DX, the show that brings you interviews with people just like you, whose lives were forever changed by a medical diagnosis. I'm Lita.
Oh, I'm Ron.
Yes,
and I'm Jean Marie.
Collectively, we're the host of Podcast DX. On today's show, we're speaking with Shannon Wyatt. Shannon is here to talk about two rare inherited diseases, von Hippel-Lindau syndrome, or VHL, and I apologize for my pronunciation. I broke two front teeth, and Chuvash polycythemia. I hope I said that right. Hi there, Shannon.
Hi, Shannon.
Yeah, good morning.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Let's get started real quick with what symptoms did you have that first led you to seek out medical care?
The only symptom that led to my VHL diagnosis was that I had kidney cancer when I was 34.
Wow.
And that was just an incidental finding because I had had a back surgery and I had some new back pain, and they're a little gun shy. So they did an MRI and there was a tumor on my left kidney. They came in and said, everything's fine with your back, but we've got some other things to talk about.
Wow. That's terrible, actually.
Shocking.
Yes. So basically the symptom of the back pain led to the testing, and then that led to the determination of what the problem was, right? Oh, at least for the kidney cancer. But what about the entire VHL thing? I kind of did a little bit of research about it. That's a pretty rare disease. How did that diagnosis come about?
Yeah, so when they took that tumor out, they did routine testing, found it was malignant, renal cell carcinoma. And because that's so rare in that age group, they recommended genetic testing to determine if maybe that was what caused it. And in fact, it was a VHL tumor. One of the classic VHL symptoms are kidney cysts that turn into tumors.
Okay.
And it happens to be, I'm one of the very rare few, that my VHL mutation is also associated and more strongly associated with the Chuvash polycythemia. So it was kind of a twofer.
Okay. All right. Well, at least you were diagnosed quickly. In a lot of cases with rare disease, it takes years and years. So I'm kind of glad that at least they caught it quickly.
And
yeah, for sure.
And can you tell us a little bit about each of these conditions and how they manifest, and also like what are the complications with each?
Yeah, so with the VHL, it's a little bit of what landed me here. The tumors, the malignant tumors, are usually in the kidneys, and then it's a series of mostly hemangiomas that develop in a lot of the abdominal cavity, and also the eyes, common in the eyes, the brain, and the spinal cord. So those are more problematic from the perspective of their presence and pushing on other structures.
Okay.
But the kidney tumors and also adrenal tumors happen a lot with VHL, and those are the ones that become especially problematic. The kidney tumors because they're malignant, the adrenal tumors because they, cause so many domino effects.
Mm-hmm. Hormonal basically?
Yeah, and a lot of the stuff with heart rate and and anxiety, it's just constantly having like a cortisol dump. They just get overactive.
Sure.
And then the Chuvash polycythemia, and it's now kind of transitioning to being termed more Chuvash erythrocytosis, because it doesn't act like the other polycythemias very well. But that's a bleeding disorder, like it sounds, and it's a really high level of red blood cells, hemoglobin, hematocrit, and the major problem with that disorder is blood clots.
Okay.
So unfortunately for that one, a lot of people, by the time they have a symptom or find out about it, it's because they're having a very severe thrombosis mm-hmm. type of event.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, we've been talking a lot about rare diseases recently. We've been kind of focusing on them. And typically, it's really difficult for somebody to have one rare disease, but a combination of two sounds terribly hard. Shannon, had you heard of these conditions before your diagnosis? And the follow-up question would be, do you know anybody else that has these conditions, like family or friends?
No, it like you said, it's very rare. Mm-hmm. In fact, I find that a lot of you know, family practice physicians or emergency room physicians, you know, I may be the first patient that they've seen in their career mm-hmm. with it. But, you know, both of them did require the genetic testing. And, you know, for me, of course, these two are caused by the same mutation. So typically, you know, you wouldn't see two super rare in the same patient for sure,
right,
but
right.
I can see where it makes sense.
Right, because
case.
Of the same gene. Right, right. I understand that. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And thankfully, my parent who gave it to me does not have the manifestation.
Okay.
And I'm an only child, and he's an only child.
Okay.
And his dad was an only child.
Okay.
So we somehow just followed that line down where each of the single children got it.
Right, right, right. Okay, thank you.
And were his parents from the Chuvash region?
No. So I've actually done a lot of genealogy mm-hmm. in light of
sure,
this,
of course.
Because there was certainly a lot of question of where it came from. Once I was really able to track, you know, through my dad and his dad and his mom, you know, I've been looking for that one individual because mm-hmm. it really does, from everything that I know about this genetic mutation, it really starts in this one region mm-hmm. in the Kuvashia Republic in Russia. And from what I can tell from several genetic analyses, I have one Eastern European ancestor okay. about 8 generations back. And I just
wow.
haven't quite put my finger on it yet.
Wow.
But
yeah.
isn't it crazy
it
to think
is.
How you like genetically win that lottery?
Yeah, right. Have you done the DNA test with Ancestry.com?
Or similar?
Yeah, so I've done Ancestry uh-huh. and 23andMe.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And when I became very curious because again, with this mutation, by the literature, it would suggest that if you have one copy of the mutation, like I do, that you don't have the Kuvash polycythemia and are spared the VHL, which hmm. is completely the opposite of every other mutation on the VHL gene. And for some reason, I ended up manifesting the VHL, and I have what... seems to be a more mild case of the Kuvash
okay.
compared to especially individuals in Kuvashia with two copies.
Okay.
So
okay.
I got really curious about what might be contributing. So I did a whole genome sequencing.
Sure, sure.
And kind of lining up that data. It's all evolving, which is the beautiful part about the time that we live in.
It absolutely is. I was just thinking the same thing. Thank God for the internet and how far we can reach and how deep we can reach. Whereas, you know, think even 50 years ago, you might not have been able to get that information.
Right.
Yeah, and that the Kuvash polycythemia is that rapidly evolving in its understanding. Scientifically and medically, you know, we're talking like 20 years ago when it was described as a standalone disorder originating in this population. And, you know, since then, having the genetic understanding and even the treatment and medical approach to it, as you can tell from the name, continues to evolve very rapidly.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
And I actually have two follow-up questions.
We
in our research, we found that they kept referring to a historical event that resulted in this mutation. In your research, have you figured out what that historic event might have been?
No, other than that they will also refer to it as like the originating individual.
Oh, okay.
So it would appear that right now the leading theory is that there's one specific individual in that region that this occurred in and then manifest through that population.
Okay.
Which then spread very lightly. I mean, it's still pretty rare, but it spread across the whole world.
And you seem extraordinarily knowledgeable. Do you have a career in medicine?
So I'm a data scientist in biomedical sciences.
Okay.
All right.
So, you know, I guess that probably explains the drive to pull all of that genetic data together.
Sure.
I feel like I don't necessarily have the answer, but it's right there in that pile of data. As soon as we just get the right direction on mm-hmm. where to look. But yeah, my background is biomedical sciences and statistical programming.
Okay.
And Shannon, how have you and your healthcare team gone about treating your condition?
Besides taking that kidney out.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, they took, thankfully, where my first tumor was in a location that was easy to do a partial nephrectomy.
Oh, okay.
So they were able to spare the majority of my left kidney. And then it was after that surgery that we identified that it was VHL, which really changed the trajectory of treatment and the plan. So now instead of, you know, we see a tumor and panic, like we did, we see the cysts or tumors as they develop. We keep monitoring them each year. And the plan, instead of going after each one, is to wait until the biggest one is at a point that it's potentially causing a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they'll go in and take everything that they can, that they know of at the moment. So limiting it to a single approach. But unfortunately, until the last, I would say, year, 2 years, that has really been about the only treatment for VHL. It's a watch and react. It's not a disorder where they can prevent the tumors from happening, although there's some clinical trials that are very promising right now. Ultimately, you know, I describe VHL and the Kuvash as well as a disorder of my body not recognizing that I have enough oxygen in my cells.
Okay.
So every single cell is sending out this signal that it's not getting enough oxygen. And so the body is trying to compensate for that, which is why you get these hemangiomas in various places. It's just building a lot of vessels there to try to get more blood to it.
Okay.
But it's an error signal, really.
Okay. What about gene editing or something?
Yeah, so gene therapies are certainly in the works, not in clinical trials yet, but there is a medication that's being trialed through MD Anderson that has been very, very promising. And it essentially just interrupts that signal.
Okay.
So it from the clinical trials that we've seen, it has very effectively either stopped progression of tumors or even in some cases reduced tumors.
Nice.
And are you at all involved in that clinical study?
I'm not, because they had removed my main tumor just before those clinical trials got started. And some of the key measurements there are the size and growth or reduction of the tumors.
I see. Okay.
So I watched that one from afar.
Okay.
But I will say that, you know, it was the first surgery that I had afterwards. I had a blood clot, which had, you know, everybody's eyes on that because mm-hmm. I had blood thinners for that surgery. And then here, just about 6 months ago, I had my gallbladder removed, totally unrelated, and I ended up with a pulmonary embolism in each lung.
Oh, no. Oh,
which wow. are exactly what Kuvash does. So up until then, even though we knew the genetic component of it, mm-hmm. you know, we all kind of just had our fingers crossed that the VHL was all I would manifest.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I'm on blood thinners, and, you know, that my hematologist tells me that it will be blood thinners for life. That has probably been the most day-to-day life-changing.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
The VHL treatment and, you know, doing routine scans each year is a thing where I can, like, it sucks, quite honestly.
Right.
You know, you just brace yourself going in, and it's like three or four awful days,
mm-hmm.
and then it's over for another year. You can kind of like put it on the shelf,
right?
But the Kuvash is, it affects the daily life. It's okay. blood thinners and you know, constant monitoring of how I'm clotting,
mm-hmm.
and then, you know, the rough part of that is that other routine things, like, you know, I have a herniated disc in my back, but they can't basically do anything that punctures the skin. No injections, no surgical treatments, and leaves everybody in a bit of a bind. It just really restricts how much you can do
right.
day-to-day life or medically.
Right.
So things like vaccination, for example, is that something that is that an option for you for like for the COVID vaccine? Do they have...
So the vaccinations are okay. Because in those cases, you know, they're working to control the bleeding at the injection site.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas things like an epidural injection
right.
brings the risk of the bleeding within that spinal canal.
Sure. So you got to be very, very cautious in your life.
Yeah,
I mean, I was jokingly talking during a recent episode that I was on just on a baby aspirin, just as a blood thinner at one time, and I was out clipping some rose bushes, and I clipped an artery or something with a thorn, and I just stood there and watched it going squirt, 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 and Jean said, "That's not good, Ma." But you got to really be careful, because even a slight something like that could really cause long-term problems.
Or even flossing. You can have, you know...
Oh, yeah, dental.
Yeah,
dental.
Think about that. Yeah, right.
Right.
It's amazing how it really does affect every single thing that you do. And, you know, it feels like you're kind of walking a very fine line because the alternative to not mm-hmm. have them
mm-hmm. yes.
poses such a significant risk of a blood clot, and as you all know very well, a silent killer.
Yeah. Right.
Sure.
And actually, I have another follow-up question. I'm so sorry. Are you restricted in terms of travel then? Are you permitted to do, you know, air travel? Or, you know, do they ask you to make sure that you're walking around if you do take a flight? Or are there any concerns in regards to that?
So, you know, so here's the very difficult thing about the Kuvash especially. There are very few individuals in the U.S. that are specialists in that area, and mm-hmm. none of them are in Texas. When I say very few, I can think of three off the top of my head.
Okay.
So there aren't even, from my medical team, there aren't specific do or don't do. It's more like they put out there, here are all of the possibilities, and we don't know
mm-hmm.
what might impact you.
Mm-hmm.
So an aspect of Kuvash is low systemic blood pressure, which is something I've always had,
mm-hmm.
With high pulmonary pressure.
Okay.
And so it masks this possibility of rupture, mm-hmm. an aneurysm.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that they put on the table is, you know, when you get into a flight, that if you are at that time having high pulmonary pressure, it could cause that event.
Oh, wow.
But there's really no way to prevent it. So it's a lot like the other things that, you know, we were talking about with day-to-day life,
mm-hmm.
That, you know, it's a constant stop, weigh out the risk,
mm-hmm.
and decide, knowing full well what may happen, how badly you want to do it. So in general, I don't travel a lot, but when it's really important and meaningful, I do the things that you listed there, like making sure I move around plenty.
We are going to have a special episode on travel with disabilities in a couple of months. We'll make sure that we ask that guest to do a little bit of research on basically people traveling with blood thinners to see if she can come up with any suggestions that might help you.
Yeah, because it can be very stressful. The possibility of ending up in a different location than home.
Absolutely.
And running out of medication.
Absolutely.
Jeez.
I know.
It's a lot. Everything day to day.
Right.
But if for all of this to happen to someone, I will say someone with, a background in statistics, at least, you know, because it has to be overwhelming. But has that helped you find a balance? Do you kind of just work with that mindset?
You know, I think that it's a double-edged sword.
Okay.
It's very helpful to me to be able to read and interpret all of the medical literature, mm-hmm. and be very up to date and very informed,
mm-hmm.
and also to take it in with a very realistic recognition of the statistical probabilities, okay. of each of those events. But at the same time, you know, it's
personal. It's
you know what's around every corner,
right.
and it can be just daunting some
right,
days.
Right. Well, I know Ron was going to ask you if you had any surgical procedures, but it was just the kidney removal, right?
Yep. And then since then, you know, it's been the effort first to minimize surgical procedures,
mm-hmm.
You know, to be able to do as much as we can when we do have to do another one.
Okay.
Well,
but
then,
even since then has been the blood clots, which make it, you know, much more concerning.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we want to make sure that we don't schedule a procedure until we absolutely have to.
Oh, absolutely.
Then in that regard, what can you do and what do you find effective in terms of alternative therapies like massage therapy, acupuncture, or heat? Because you can't have procedures like you were saying for your
back. Right.
So what helps you get through that?
And Reiki. I suggest Reiki. Have you heard of Reiki?
Oh boy!
Yeah,
why not? Jeez, old
okay,
boy!
But I had just Reiki. I'm like, right in my ear.
I'm sorry.
I will say that you know, I come from a very biomedical sciences background,
mm-hmm.
very scientific, and prior to any of this, you know, I was in that typical Western medicine mindset of, if it doesn't come in a bottle, it's not effective.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And, you know, unfortunately, in this situation, when you become limited on what you can do,
mm-hmm.
you start opening your mind to all of the other possibilities,
mm-hmm.
and you get into a lot of what can it hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of is my approach on alternative therapies.
Okay.
If it's not going to exacerbate the problem,
mm-hmm.
why not?
Right.
And that ends up being really a lot of my go-to for everything else. You know, as I mentioned early in the discussion, this impacts the ability to treat other basic things.
Right.
You know, a herniated disc,
right.
for example.
Right.
So I end up doing a lot of, for those types of conditions, massage therapy, different, especially sports medicine, a lot of sports medicine therapies, and heat and ice and, you know, more of the practical, what folks might term like home remedies, but things that you just know, like elevating things when they're inflamed, and instead of trying to go to a medication.
Sure. Okay. Sure.
Yeah, I can understand that. And I actually, I don't know, I keep stepping on everybody else's toes. Okay. Here.
I started the whole problem, so.
Okay, all right.
I'm going to wear steel-toed boots.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, this is a lot to take on for, you know, for one person. Mm-hmm. What about mental health? And, you know, have you?
Ooh.
I
mean, yeah, so, you know, it is a lot. And I will say, if I had to identify the single most difficult aspect of all of this, it's simply dealing with doctors and the medical community. It's not the, as bizarre as that sounds, it's not the conditions themselves or the problems that they cause. It's trying to get someone to help you and to be on your team. You know, I will say that what I see is a healthcare system that's overburdened. We have, for each physician, they have so many patients to manage, to take care of, that it's really hard for them to dive in and get heavily invested.
Right.
And, you know, that's the impact that I see on rare diseases. I'm sure you all are familiar with the mantra, if you hear hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras.
Right, right.
And we're all thankful for the doctor that sees the zebra.
Right.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And I get so frustrated, exasperated, overwhelmed, feeling like I am carrying the burden of my own medical care, and constantly feeling like I'm going on dates with doctors. Like, you know, are we going to work? Are we going to be able to... are you going to be on my team?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And if I'm, you know, just being perfectly honest, the majority of them are not. The majority of them see the hoofbeats as a horse and want to treat it that way and keep it moving out the door. So, you know, I'm just like 4 years into this at this point. The kidney cancer was 4 years ago. And it kind of feels like it's been a snowball since then. And the biggest thing that I found is if I didn't have a therapist to talk to about a lot of these things, I would have really spiraled really hard by now. There are times that I simply avoid going to an emergency room or a doctor, even though I know I need to, even though the symptoms warrant it, because I just don't want to do that song and dance again. And in that moment, it's really, really helpful to have that objective third party who has your mental health at heart to tell you, you know, this is something, even if you need someone to hold your hand, this is something you need to go do.
Right, right, right. Very good.
Yeah.
Good
advice. And but I'm sorry to hear that, you know, you've experienced that. And we do have a number of listeners who are currently medical students, and hopefully they'll really take that to heart as well and let that guide the way that they see and view and treat patients.
Right, right.
So I actually have more of a personal question here, and let me know if it's too much, but how has it... having the conditions that you have, how has that influenced your decision to have children?
So, unfortunately, but yeah, I have them, fortunately. I had my children before I had either of these diagnoses.
Gotcha.
And again, that ties very closely into the mental health discussion there, because... it was a very heartbreaking realization to know that every child has a 50% chance of inheriting this. And, you know, that the idea that I have saddled any of them with this just tears you up. That thought is far worse than dealing with the diseases themselves.
Okay. Gotcha.
Wasn't thinking, I thought his question meant like as far as giving birth and the process of giving birth. You know, you're talking about, you weren't on blood thinners then.
No, okay. She said no. This was prior to it. Right. Yeah. Okay.
And I had the same view of the question because I know I have a couple of genetic, and they're spontaneous genetic mutations, and as a result decided not to have children. And it's hard, I think, either way. But I really hope that you're at the point or you get to the point where you don't blame yourself.
Yeah.
And I think your children are very lucky to have you as a parent. And I think that, you know, yeah, they're very lucky.
But even just having the knowledge.
Right.
Once you've had she's had the children, and having the knowledge that there may be a problem, at least the child or the children will be able to know what to look for.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to she was in, you were in the dark, right?
Well, this
was
right. And I think we all, you know, like as you age and as, you know, you grow up, there are those things that'll just pop up. And not everything's caught early on, and they may have that as an advantage,
right?
Where things can be caught early on, And as you said, you know, with the clinical trials with medication, that may be an option for them as well.
Yeah, and I do know. Had I known beforehand, sometimes ignorance is bliss, of course.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Had I known beforehand, I very much would have done IVF with PGD in order to identify the embryos with the condition and not pass it on.
Okay.
But regardless, here we are. And the beauty, much like you were just saying, is that if any of our children have the same mutation, you know, I'm there to champion the same as I would have done, you know, for them so that they don't experience any sort of guilt.
Right. Thank you.
Yes.
Shannon, what support have you received during this journey? Like your family or friends, have they helped you at all in your healthcare journey?
Yeah. I mean, so my husband is a huge supporter. My kids are fantastic. You know, you kind of live with that mommy guilt all the time. Like, because I can't get out of bed this week, you know, that I'm negatively impacting their childhood experience. But, you know, they are outstanding. They are, and again, kudos to my husband. He really encourages them to be there and be supportive too. So definitely they are kind of my core support. Yes. And then my extended family, for sure, are, you know, cheerleaders from more of a distance. But then beyond that, and my therapist, of course, but beyond that, I only really share with a few very close friends. It takes a while before I will share with any friends.
And I hate to tell you, but this is gonna publicize around the world. Is that okay? Okay. I'm thinking, did I tell her this? Okay. All right. I just wanted to make sure we knew that. All right. Good.
No, but you know, it has a tendency to just kind of put a dark cloud over things.
Yeah,
people don't really know how to respond, or how to be supportive because it's just so heavy and it's so big.
Right.
And, you know, I tend to be a people pleaser, so I start trying to comfort other people in their discomfort of knowing it. So
working
it's easier
it.
You know, enjoy the friendships as they are without adding that to the mix.
Well, that tends to be a recurring theme when we hear people talk and they talk about their friends and how they react to it. They don't know how to react.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's good that you make them feel a little bit easier about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, if a person has been in your life playing a significant part in your life, after a certain amount of time, it's much easier for them to have a genuine concern type of reaction instead of, you know, feeling like they have to say something or have to do something.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. You already let them in, so it's easy to have that connection.
Exactly.
And how common is...
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'm going to step on her now.
I got to the point where I started just listening to you.
She was crying.
And forgetting that I was supposed to be asking you questions.
How common is it to have VHL and shoe rush?
So VHL, there are a little over like 350 different mutations on the VHL gene. So there are a lot of ways to have VHL. But still, it's quite rare. You know, VHL is an autosomal dominant condition. So if you have one copy of the mutation, you will have VHL. And so, again, that would make it seem like it would be more prevalent. But instead, it's about 1 in 36,000 people have VHL.
Okay.
And to kind of put that a little more into perspective, in the U.S., that equates to about 9,000 people total in the U.S.
Okay. Are there any specialists for this condition in the United States?
Yeah. So VHL, even though it is that rare, still has quite a number of VHL specialists. Okay. There are, you know, I go to MD Anderson, the VHL clinic there, and I want to say off the top of my head, there are approximately 10, give or take, VHL clinics across the country.
That's good.
So there are specialists for that for sure.
Okay.
The Kuvash, on the other hand, is just extremely rare.
Okay.
And like I said earlier, I can think of three specialists or even, you know, they're all hematologists, but mm-hmm. they're hematologists that are actually up on Kuvash.
Okay.
But I think only three in the U.S. And even at this point, last I checked, there was not a solid estimate of prevalence for Kuvash because it's so rare, except that in Russia, mm-hmm. In the Kuvashia Republic, there are 200 documented cases in a population of 1.5 million.
Wow. I mean, that's
they're
very, very, very rare.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I can see how it would be hard to find a specialist with
something
so rare.
Right.
In fact, when my genetic testing results came back, it had been like weeks. Mm-hmm. And I called to find out, you know, how it was going. And essentially, it was the genetic specialist having ongoing debate about how to report it as, you know, it is a condition or it isn't a condition.
Wow.
It's heterozygous, but VHL is autosomal dominant. It, like, got them all twisted into knots, and that isn't common.
Right. So where they don't even see it.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
You rewrote the book with them, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, that's exactly what my VHL specialist tends to say, that apparently my mutation did not read the textbook. This is not what it's supposed to be doing.
Right. Shannon, do you have any additional hints, tips, or advice for somebody that was recently diagnosed with a rare disease?
You know, the biggest one is to seek support. To, you know, connect with others, either with a similar condition, the same condition, just other rare disorder patients, because their stories will help you feel not so alone. And then, you know, really pushing through. You know, you hear this all the time, that you have to be your own advocate.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really, really hard when you're in a doctor's office and they're shooing you out the door. And it feels like they're just shushing you. And you know, this is where it's really important to have another person, you know, because it's not happening to them.
Mm-hmm.
They are really much more able to speak up and say, you know, before we go,
right,
this really is bothering her.
Right.
And I don't feel comfortable with us leaving without
right.
an answer.
Right.
Where that's really hard to say yourself. And I think my husband, in the 4 years that we've been doing this, has now gotten to a place where, you know, we've had those conversations where I've said, this is what I need you to do because I find this difficult, or mm-hmm. I can't
mm-hmm.
when I'm in that room, mm-hmm. I can't say these things. I need mm-hmm. you to be my voice.
That's good.
And he has jumped right in there.
That's
so
super.
It's the support, but it's also pushing your medical team when you know something isn't right, or you feel like your concerns aren't addressed, go on a date with a new doctor.
Right.
Right. Right. Right. Right.
Yeah. That's great advice.
Right. Absolutely. It is. Yes. Well, we do really appreciate you joining our show today, mm-hmm. Shannon. And we'll be putting up links on our website for our listeners so that they can learn more about VHL and Kuvash. Do you have any social media presence, any links you'd like to share with us that we can put up also?
So I'll share with you after our call. But
sure.
The big one is VHL Alliance. The VHL Alliance website and social media pages do a great job of advocating for VHL patients and also disseminating all of the very rapidly evolving medical advice and literature.
Okay, great.
Yeah, great. That's fantastic.
Yep.
Well, Shannon, thank you for being part of the show today. Thank you for taking the time. And we wish you all the best in the future. In your life and your healthcare.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Thank you.
If any of our listeners have questions or comments related to today's show, they can contact us at podcastdx@yahoo.com, on our website, podcastdx.com, Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, or Instagram.
And if you have a moment to spare, please give us a review wherever you get your podcast. As always, please keep in mind that this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment, and always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment or before undertaking a new healthcare regime, and never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this podcast.
I'm going to slow down and say, till next week.